Plan Evaluation Advisory Committee meeting. We are in room 1000 at the Utah State Tax Commission building. It's 10 o'clock. We are located at 210 North 1950 West Salt Lake City. I'm Commissioner Robert Pirro. I'm the chairman of the committee. I want to go around the table and let everyone introduce themselves. And when you do, the recording last year was not very good because the mics were too far away. So if you'd pull the mic closer to you, and as you introduce yourself, give me your title and how you were, what brought you to this committee.
All right, I'm Dylan Fates. I'm department head at Applied Economics at Utah State University. And effectively, I'm replacing Don Snyder on this committee representing Utah State University. And Don retired June 30th, so he's no longer with us. What else do you need from me?
That covers it.
I'm Robert Lee. I'm a research assistant at Utah State University, and I assisted in preparing the report.
Scott Erickson. I'm the deputy commissioner at the Department of Agriculture and Food, and I am here on assignment from Commissioner Adams.
Sterling Brown, vice president of public policy for the Utah Farm Bureau. I'm not a committee member, but advisory or ex officio member.
Rex Larson, Larson Family Farms, appointed as a representative for agriculture in the state.
Denny Lytle, Property Tax Division Director, as staff to the commission.
Do you want to introduce you to the rest of your crew? And
no.
Well, I'll do it. Gerald Osborne, the next three are from the property tax. Gerald Osborne, Jennifer Condi, and Craig Jolly. And we also have with us
Ryan Larson.
Ryan Larson.
He's at Utah State University as well and help with this report.
All right, now that we have got past that, Greg Garf is also on the board, and he's been excused. We've not heard from him, so we don't know what his status is, but we have enough here to have a quorum so we can continue with our meeting. The first thing that we always have to do is go through our Open and Public Meeting Act. Normally, Commissioner Cragen is here in person to do this, but he has come up with this slideshow to go ahead and do it for us. So by law, we have to have this training annually every year since we are a public body. So we will go ahead and do that. Krista has to move one wire.
Hello, I'm Michael Cragen. And this is Utah Open and Public Meetings Act for Basics. This presentation is designed to satisfy the requirement that all public bodies receive annual training on Utah's Open and Public Meetings Act. Please note that in the bottom left-hand corner of each slide is a statutory reference for the topics discussed. We'll begin with the legislature's policy declaration that the government of Utah is conducting the people's business and it should take its actions openly and conduct its deliberations openly. The legislature has specified that all meetings of the government are open to the public unless closed for a limited number of reasons. This definition of a meeting contains three elements. We'll look at each in turn. Let's begin by looking at the definition of a public body. The Open and Public Meetings Act applies to public bodies. This definition of public body contains five elements. Four of those elements could apply to any government officer who has the authority to make decisions. The most important element for us to review is that a public body consists of two or more persons. An individual is not subject to the Open and Public Meetings Act. Next, we look at whether a quorum of the public body is present. The statute that creates a public body might specify the number of members that constitutes a quorum. If the statute is silent, then the Open Public Meetings Act provides that a simple majority of the public body is a quorum. The final element is whether or not a meeting has been convened. Everyone likely understands that when a public body is gathered together to take action on some matter over which it has responsibility, that it is convened in a meeting and subject to the Open and Public Meetings Act. It's also important for us to understand that when a public body has gathered to discuss a matter over which it has responsibility, that is also the convening of a meeting and is subject to the Open Public Meetings Act. The legislature provides an exception, permitting members of public bodies to share information with each other by electronic messages when they are not convening public meetings. However, this may not be used as a way to conduct a vote. Let's now look at the requirements for holding a public meeting. First are notice requirements. A public body that has regular meetings throughout the year is required to post an annual notice at the beginning of the year specifying the dates and times that it will meet. All public bodies are required to post a notice at least 24 hours before the meeting, which has a date, time, and place, and includes an agenda of the topics that will be discussed. These must be posted in the office of the public body, posted on the Utah Public Notice website, and sent to a newspaper. Next on our list is the agenda. The items listed must be reasonably clear so that the people understand what will be discussed before the public body meets. It is okay for a public body to discuss an item that is not on the agenda, but that may not take final action until the item has been posted on the agenda. Public bodies must record all of their meetings. The recording must be posted on the Utah Public Notice website within 3 days of the meeting. Any information presented at the meeting must be included in the official record. A set of pending minutes must be created and made available within 30 days of the meeting. They have to have a note on them indicating that the meeting minutes are pending and may change prior to the approval of the public body. The body must meet in an open meeting and vote to approve their minutes, and once that happens, those minutes become the official record of the meeting, which must be posted on the Utah Public Notice website within 3 days. Public bodies are permitted to hold electronic meetings, but must first adopt a resolution, rule, or ordinance that specifies how those meetings will be conducted. Next, we look at closed meetings. With a very limited exception, no public body is required to hold a closed meeting. Public bodies who hold closed meetings may only discuss these 7 topics. An exception is that a public body filling a vacancy in an elected position must conduct that business in public. To hold a proper closed meeting, the public body must start in an open meeting with a quorum present. At least two-thirds of the members present must approve closing the meeting. The reason and the location for the closed meeting must be announced in the open meeting. And the reasons and location of the meeting and the votes by name of the members must be included in the minutes of the open meeting. Once it's in a closed meeting, the public body may take no actions. It may take minutes, but is not required to do so. It must record the meeting, but may choose not to record the meeting when discussing these two particular topics. Once the public body finishes its confidential discussions, it must return to an open meeting to take any action. If a recording was not made because of the two exceptions permitted, then the chair must sign a sworn statement indicating that the body discussed only those topics. If a quorum of a public body happens to show up at the same grocery store at the same time, the statute specifies that that is not immediate. Likewise, if a quorum of a public body is all attending the same holiday party at the same time, that is not immediate. Bodies with executive and legislative powers, such as a city council or a county commission, meeting only to discuss administrative functions, is not an immediate. Finally, the Utah State Tax Commission, when discussing confidential tax matters, is not holding a meeting. However, these exceptions may not be used as a way to get around the Open and Public Meetings Act. Finally, the public body is permitted to remove a disruptive person from the meeting. The public may sue to void the final action of a public body that was not done in compliance with the Open and Public Meetings Act, and a prosecutor or the public may sue to compel a public body to comply with the Open and Public Meetings Act. A judge is permitted to review the recording of a closed meeting to determine if a violation has occurred, and if there is a violation found, the court impose a criminal sanction. This ends the annual training on the Open and Public Meetings Act. Thank you for your attention.
Any questions? All right. Let's go to item 3 on our agenda. This is a period of time where we allow public comment. Any individual in the audience that would like to address the board for up to 3 minutes can take that opportunity to now. Do we have anyone? Not seeing anyone. We will go to item number 4, and we are going to approval of the pending minutes of September 29th, 2015. This is an action item. Has the board reviewed the minutes?
Yes.
Can someone make a motion to approve?
I'll make that motion, Rex Larson.
Second.
Okay, I have a motion and a second. Any debate on the motion? Okay, I'll call for a vote. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes. Now we'll get to the heart of why we're here. Item number 5. Presentation of the draft farmland evaluation report by Utah State University on the several classifications of land in agricultural use in the various areas of the state. And I'm going to turn the time over to Dr.
Fates.
Fates. I know I'm going to say that wrong.
Won't be the first. Thank you. So I'm not for sure always what Don Snyder presented in the past at these meetings. I thought just a couple of comments before we discuss this year's report. Clearly there's a challenge in the state valuing agricultural land based off sales because they are relatively few in number when we look at it on a county basis. Many are not arm's length transactions, and oftentimes the land is being sold for values other than those associated strictly with farming, ranching, agriculture operations. So the commission has basically tasked Utah State with valuing the land based on the productive potential of the land. And so we attempt to do that each year, but even that becomes challenging when you think of the swings in commodity prices. This year's prices, which aren't included in the report, but prices for alfalfa or beef cattle are about half of what they were 2 years ago. And so those are the kind of swings that we have. Energy prices are one of the main drivers on the cost side of the report, and again, those swing wildly from year to year. So we've tried to, over the years, smooth that, those big swings, by looking at 4 or 5 year average output prices and then updating in input prices on a national index, basically, of prices paid, to try to smooth out those variability and look at a longer term how those land prices may change from year to year. And I think it adds some consistency. So in the past, Dr. Snyder also basically presented the report and then sat on the committee and basically voted to accept the report. And going forward, Dr. Ryan Larson is a new faculty member at Utah State University. He'll likely take the lead in preparing this report with Rob Lee, research assistant, and they'll likely present it, and then I'll be the committee member and can accept it. And that way I'm not necessarily voting on work that I've just done. And in the reality, that's basically how we did it this year. Ryan and Rob did most of the work on the report. I only supervised it a little. So with the chair's permission, I'd like Rob to go ahead and present our suggested changes for the year on the different values of cropland.
See, and I don't know how in-depth you want to be, if you want. Dylan discussed about the middle part of the report. I can kind of do an overview, read the summary, whatever you want, Denny. We'll.
But generally, I think what's helpful is to kind of go by different kind of crop, deal with the irrigated, orchard, meadow, dry, and graze separately, but I don't think you need to go to the depth of by county unless there's something that really stands out. That kind of an overview of what's happened with the irrigated ground, what has caused the changes.
Okay, yeah. See, and most of that's just put in that summary at the very start is where we put it. And just like Dylan was saying, based on the cost that farmers, or not the cost, the price that farmers are receiving has gone down, but also the cost of production went down about 6% nationally. The crop mix and the yields have stayed pretty constant this year. So the only change is that prices went down less than cost did. So there's a slight increase across the state, we would suggest, for land values. And in alfalfa, it's from the high is just a 2.8% increase in land values in Carbon County, and the low is about 0.6% in Beaver County. And the remaining counties were in between 1 and 2.7% change, so there's not a real drastic, and that's kind of what we try to do, is take those giant swings out. The orchard land showed an increase of about 2%. Production on tart cherries being the main reason for that, because the tart cherries and the apples are the main crops that drive the fruit industry in the state. They're the biggest percent. So the price went up a little, costs went down. So it's just the same as with the irrigated land, just a small increase because the cost did decrease. One thing I did notice as we were working on this is apricots, you might see a giant swing because the price went way up, but production went down also. And all the information I could find, there's only must be a few apricot producers that sell them, because the information doesn't, that's a lot. It's when you go into NAS, the National Ag Statistics, if there's so few producers, they won't give you a number. It just says this is the number. So that was, but apricots really doesn't affect the orchard value that much anyways. Let's see, our next one would be the meadow. Meadow values increased just a little bit across the state. Dry farm for the same reasons. Alfalfa is the main driver in that. The inputs decreased that 6%. Prices went down. Yields were constant. So
you actually said that alfalfa is the driver for dry land?
And wheat, sorry. Yeah, okay. The small grains and alfalfa, but yeah.
And alfalfa, so there is enough dry land alfalfa to factor in?
Yeah. In some of the southern counties, it's still, I mean, alfalfa in the state as a whole is just the big driver for the prices in production, so.
So when Rob is saying costs went down or prices went down again, that's the, on the prices, that's a five-year average, yeah. 2011 to 2015, so we're not even talking about the drop in 2016 values yet. And the cost did, when you look at costs from 14 to 15, much of that is driven by energy, fuel, that then impacts fertilizer, pesticides, all your chemicals are driven by that. And so there was a significant drop in from 14 to 15 on the cost side, that as compared to the five-year average prices, that cost in that 1 year dropped more than our average did. And so that's why, even though 15 prices were higher than, were lower than 14, we're still recommending a slight increase, because again, smoothing that, obviously we didn't jump the prices, land values as much in 13 and 14 when those commodity prices were going up, because we were smoothing that as well. So it's just that smoothing of the transitions over years.
I think that's a really important reminder for the committee, is to understand that the data that's being used to make these recommendations is 15 data to make recommendations in 16 to use for 17. That's so a two-year lag in the valuation process, necessarily because of the data availability.
So we may get that, we may have a 2% drop next year. So this slight increase we're suggesting this year may come back off next year when we pull out the decrease in this year. So
because hay's gone down so much,
yeah,
this year.
Yes, exactly, yep. Grazing land has been pretty consistent. There's just a small increase, and then non-production, we just left the same this year. And I know last year, some of the tables in the report, we've tried to clear those up so there's not so much confusion with using the average price, because I know that was kind of a concern last year. So we kind of cleaned those up. We can go through some of the actual numbers at the end of the report in the tables if you'd like, or if you just have any additional questions that we can help you with.
Question on page 3, bullet point number 1, there in the middle. The report says there's over 100 budgets, and those are those budgets are updated every 5 or 6 years. So that's approximately 16, something between 15 and 16 budgets are updated per year. Does that sound about right?
We've kind of lagged the last few years, but with Ryan and I, that's kind of what we're going to be catching up a little quicker, is kind of our plan moving forward. So those budgets will be more up to date.
Were there any of the budgets updated this year going into this report?
No, we made the decision where this was my first time doing the report, as well as Ryan's, to leave the basic budgets the same and just update the index, the costs, and put the new five-year average prices, but in terms of changing the technology coefficients on any of the budgets, we didn't. And that's the main thing that we try to change when we update those budgets, is to go back on a county-by-county basis and make sure that the technology we're using is still representative of the largest percentage of producers. And so, you know, I think if you look 10 or 15 years ago, you probably had the bulk of alfalfa, for example, would have been small square bales. Well, now we've almost all those budgets are the big ton balers, because we've updated that far. But have we included anything on some of the newer automated techniques on that? Probably not. Pivot versus flood irrigation, some counties that's changed more. And so as we go back through, we'll want to just make sure that those budgets are in line with practices. And again, on any given county, you still have people putting up hay and crops with vastly different machinery complements. One guy's got the 20-year-old combine that he's still running, and the next guy's got the fully automated GPS capable. And so we try to hit a balance on that as well, that we're not showing everybody with the newest, but we're also not showing everybody with obsolete. So we try to visit with people within the counties, get an idea of kind of what the most common practices are, and update those budgets. But we will probably in the next 2 years try to update a lot of those. And even though we do a budget for every county, obviously many of the counties have, when we update one county, the adjacent county can be updated the same way. So it's not that some of those, Wasatch Front budgets are probably going to look similar, but they may look considerably different than Uinta Basin. And so we could update all the Wasatch Front at the same time, Uinta Basin another year, Southeast another year, and that's kind of the rotation we try to do.
Is there any data available as of yet on the amounts, returns, costs associated with the smaller operations, the farmers market producers, the vegetable producers, the small berry producers?
There's been a little, vegetables have been coming in with the USDA, but it's kind of spotty. And most of it is, if I remember right, is here in, Salt Lake County, Utah County, Weber County, right here. But it's coming slow. It's like safflower. Safflower 5 years ago was hardly anywhere, but now it's starting to gain some momentum, and there's quite a bit coming on.
So the reason I ask that question is, under urban farming, the current law is that they just use the highest FAA value for the urban farming ground. And at some point, we're going to have to look at that in a little more detail to see if there's a big enough disparity that we need to do something, or if maintaining the highest value for FAA is a reasonable approach.
But how many folks are taking advantage of that?
You can count them on one hand.
So, yes, it may become an issue at some point, but at this point, we don't have the volume to be overly concerned with it.
Absolutely, I agree. But I suspect that
with two contiguous acres on that law, it's pretty difficult for somebody, especially on the Wasatch Front, to tie that together.
If they expand it to more counties, though.
Yeah, that's not just a challenge for Utah, it's a challenge nationally. Trying to get price reports on farmers markets, the direct marketing to chefs, or
you pick
the baskets that get delivered, all of those. Ag marketing service nationally has had a real challenge trying to come up with ways to capture those markets. I think on the livestock side, sheep and goats, there's some states where they estimate a third of the sheep and goats are these private type sales that they really have no market data on and can't get it. And so it's a challenge. We've at the university, we've looked some at trying to help the farmers markets with reports, but yeah, so the small scale agriculture in these urban fringes, trying to value that is that's a challenge. And
isn't it growing though?
Yes it is. I mean, it's a growing percentage of the market, and even, you know, we try to capture beef and dairy, and we primarily go in with commodity values, and yet anybody that's doing some organic or natural and putting that into some specific value chains, their prices are much different, but some of their costs are also higher. So, you know, ultimately we're trying to look at profitability, and so yeah, some of these farmer markets have much higher values, but when you look at their cost per acre that they're applying as compared to a larger conventional, they have much higher labor costs. And so yes, I'm sure the profitability is higher on a per acre basis, but I know it's not as high as just the difference in the price that they're receiving for their.
The one we're seeing requests on FAA more recently is the farm to table issue. So where they're actually trying to have a producing operation that goes directly to their restaurant that sits on location, and that data is going to be virtually impossible to get, I bet.
Yeah, and at what point does the cost stop being an agriculture cost and start being the retail restaurant cost? And
anyone have any questions? Well, that's about the easiest this has ever gone. Well, that'll move us to item number 6, recommendation to the Utah State Tax Commission for a range of values for land in the various areas of the state based upon productive capabilities of the land when devoted to agriculture uses per Utah Code Annotated 592-514. This is an action item, so we'll have a motion and vote on it.
So I'll move that we accept the report that's been prepared by Utah State University and the values outlined therein.
I'll second that.
Okay. Any debate on the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. These values will be incorporated by the Property Tax Division into a proposed Tax Commission Administrative Rule R884-24P-53. 2017 valuation guides for valuation of land subject to farmland to the Farmland Assessment Act. On Tuesday, October 4th, 2016, the Commission will vote to accept and publish the proposed values in the Rules Bulletin for public comment. The proposed rule amendment would be available for public comment for 30 days from November 1st, 2016 to December 1st, 2016. The rule will likely be scheduled for final consideration at the Public Commission meeting on December 8th, 2016. Do we have any other items? Do you have some suggested dates for the next meeting?
No, just one of the report.
Pardon?
It needs to be probably sooner.
We've had problems putting this meeting too close to when it has to meet the approval dates. So if we could move this forward, I know you've got to get your report done, but a couple of weeks would help, wouldn't it?
It would, but it's a real crunch because the data availability has been always the driver of having the data available and still being able to do the calculations and analysis.
But it has gotten better, so I think we could feasibly move it up a couple of weeks for you.
If we could be in the middle of September, that would be helpful. Yeah.
So like the Wednesday, there's the 13th, September 13th. That works for everyone.
That week every year I have national meetings.
Oh, you do? How about the week before?
The week before we got.
And that's the 6th, September 6th? Same time?
Can you take that, Rob?
Okay. You guys think you can meet that schedule?
I think so. Brian?
So the problem is, though, for them to get the data from you.
But, if it's easier to go that week after and go to the 20th, that's a week earlier.
That's probably, I'm still concerned about. We can make it work from the third week. It's better and easier if we move it up a little bit, but I'm still concerned about the data. So I think it'd be more comfortable to put it the third week.
All right. So what would that be, the 20th?
September 20th.
All right, let's go with that. If we run into a problem, we can deal with that. I think that's our meeting for this year. I'd like to thank all of you for traveling to get this done. And now I'd accept a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Motion passes. We are adjourned. Thank you.